For this evening's talk, I'm going to be talking on the subject of tradition. I'm doing that because I've noticed that often that people can cite and call up tradition as an excuse for some things which are causing harm in this world or harm to themselves. And it's sometimes that people ask me, as a Buddhist, what type of tradition do you follow? And it always begs a question, tradition, should we follow it or should we change it? What are the advantages in keeping tradition, if any? What are the advantages in changing it? What actually is the tradition we should follow anyway in our life? Has it a place in our modern world? And hopefully during the next 50 minutes or so I'll be answering some of those questions. But first of all, you know, they ask me, what type of tradition are you from? And it's a great question. One of the reasons why I became a Buddhist in the first place was having a scientific training. And science was something which was always able to challenge accepted ideas and views. Tradition was something which we were challenging sometimes, but at other times we were keeping. There was a tradition of science. But that particular tradition was always to challenge everything, that everything was up to be disproved. And it was up to us to try and accept change of our traditions in the face of what was obviously going to be truthful. It was a pursuit of truth, and that became the tradition of science. And other sort of sacred cows were always subservient to that main pursuit of truth. And that was one of the reasons when I became a Buddhist and looked up in the original teachings of the Buddha, I found there was a similarity there. The real tradition which I ordained into was a tradition which would pursue truth and meaning at all costs. That was the tradition. And other things which we talk were really, we call traditions, they weren't traditions at all, they were just some cultural accretions, things which had gathered on top of Buddhism over the many centuries as it travelled from land to land, culture to culture. But the heart of it, part of it which I really enjoyed, was the fact that, no, this was the pursuit of truth, whereas science was the pursuit of truth in the outside world. That for me, that Buddhism was the pursuit of truth in the inner world, in the world especially of the mind, in meditation, in the world of feelings and emotions and relationships, a pursuit of truth in that world. And one of the reasons, again, I like becoming a Buddhist and being a Buddhist, was I could apply the same sort of ideas, the same values as in science. You could always test, you can probe, you can argue. And if it didn't match experience, you could jettison those ideas. And sometimes people say, well, you know, are you a traditionalist Buddhist? And I say, very much so. Because I saw that those were the ideas, those were the ways that we were supposed to look at life in the very earliest part of Buddhism. One of the reasons why many Westerners actually look upon Buddhism and they want to follow it is because of one particular sutta which people often quote. Someone reminded me of that just last week. It's called the Kalama Sutta, and that was a teaching which the Buddha gave to a group of people who wanted to find out what the heck should we believe in. Different teachers, different monks and nuns, different religious people, they come into our communities and one says this and another says that. What the heck are we supposed to believe anyway? And there the Buddha was very, very hard, but very wise in saying, look, do not believe in something just because it's your tradition. Don't believe in it just because it's written in some sort of book. Don't believe in it just because of somebody you really respect says it is so. Don't even believe in it if it's rational, if it's logical, because sometimes even rationality and logic, it can be based on some false premise where you don't have all the data and you jump to conclusions. But he said, make sure that, you know, that you test it out and make sure it's evidence-based, but make sure it's tested out with a mind which is free from vested interests of wanting to prove something or being afraid of what you might find out. And I'm going to mention that later on, how one finds out that truth. It's not just using your reason, not even using your experience, because even experience can be deceptive. But there is a little method which I'll mention at the very end of this talk, and how you can be sure that what you're actually seeing and experiencing is actually truthful, so you can depend upon it. But that particular teaching of not having to depend upon traditions or what you read in a book or even what a teacher says, now that really attracted me, because sometimes that I'd seen traditions, and those traditions, yeah, they said that this was our culture, this was our racial characteristics and customs, this was our traditions, therefore it must be right, and it was obviously wrong. I could see it doing so much harm to people and to things. And so just because it's a tradition, it's been there for many, many, many centuries, doesn't mean it's right. And we all know that. We've had a huge number of examples of, you know, whether slavery was a tradition, whether the traditional role of women in the family, or the traditional role of kids, or the traditional role of anybody. You know, come on, we know that sometimes that we've moved forward from those days, but still people sometimes carry on a procedure, an act, a way of doing things, simply because it's traditional, without actually seeing whether it's really right or not, whether it's really just or not. And as a person of a religion, I am very careful that whatever traditions which I carry forward are not going to be harmful, but are going to be helpful. In other words, I have to justify my actions, justify what I do and say, even justify some of the ceremonies which we do, to make sure it's going to be helpful. Not just say, well, this is the way it's been done, we have to do it this way forever afterwards. Because otherwise we get into a huge amount of problems in our world, especially in the world of religion, race and culture, when we follow a tradition which we know is obviously harmful. So we have to challenge. Now let's give some examples, just simple examples of, like, you know, the traditions of Buddhism. Somebody just asked me as I was coming in here, do you do baby blessings? Is that part of Buddhist tradition? And I said, you know, quite frankly, that I will bless anything for a cup of tea. I'm very easy going on that. But what does that actually really mean, doing a baby blessing? What's the purpose of it? So when we do any of these traditional things, if there was no purpose to it, if it was exploiting it, somebody, you know, like, you know, sometimes you put this baby in a big bucket of water and you call that a baptism, and jeepers, I mean, that must, make sure the water is at least warm before you put your baby in there. But that's not actually what we do as a blessing. It's interesting. This is just a Thai tradition. I've never seen this in Sri Lanka or Burma. But, you know, it's an interesting tradition. It's actually they get me to cut the first, give them the first haircut. It's a Thai tradition. You know, when the baby's born, you just take a few clips of their baby hair. It must be because they think that as Buddhist monks, we're very good at sort of giving haircuts. We don't give the full job to the baby, because, you know, that's going a bit too far, just a couple of... But the one tradition which I really didn't like, you know, and I think this was a tradition which I saw in Thailand, was actually when they actually gave the baby to the monk. They actually presented it. Just, you know, that sometimes you give the monks gifts, you give them a bar of chocolate or a cup of tea. Now here is a baby. And actually they really mean, this is here, you have it. And I got very worried when that first happened to me. You don't know what to do with the baby, especially if it poos and it's on your robe. You've only got one robe and it's going to smell for a long time and you can't get it off. But anyway, you know, you've got other clothes, you can go and wash them and change them, but this is it. So, but what they do, that they're giving it to you, it's almost like you're being, it's like the godfather. So they give it to you and it becomes my baby. And then I give it back to the mother or the father, say, it's my baby, but you look after it for the rest of the life. But, you know, if it gets in any trouble, I'll try and help it out. It's a nice, nice little ceremony. When it was explained to me what it really was, we're not really giving it to you, and we want it back again afterwards. That was a great that was a great relief for me. And it became like quite a nice tradition, a tradition of some sort of meaning. It was given like a connection just between myself or another monk, or just the tradition here, so that, you know, there will be a connection there. When it was a tradition with a meaning, fine. I can understand that. I can accept that. But every time I have to know that meaning, and you also have to know that meaning. Otherwise it becomes a tradition which no one knows exactly why you're doing it or what the purpose is for. And sometimes it, you know, becomes a stupid reason. Like, you know, some religions, circumcision. What are you doing that for? What's the reason? Oh, it's a tradition. That's not good enough, just saying it's a tradition. Why? And it's even in indigenous culture. Traditions. Yes, but why? Is it good? And I'm mentioning this because nothing is exempt from questioning. Just because it's a tradition, it's not good enough to say it must be right. And I got this story from Dennis Eggington. He's the head of the Aboriginal Legal Service, one of the senior indigenous people in Western Australia. Because he told me this lovely story. I was giving a talk on Buddhism and human rights in Curtin, and he was actually in the class. And when he, I'd given some of my stories, the sort of stories you hear every Friday night here, he came up with his story. He said, just, must have been two or three years ago now, there was a car crash, I think down in the southern suburbs. You know, some drunken drivers had rammed into a car and killed the occupants of that car, who were, you know, two indigenous people, young people. They were just coming back from university, just some really good kids. And they had their wives, their lives wiped out by a drunken driver. And the problem was, the drunken driver was also indigenous, which meant, according to their tradition, payback. Sort of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Something just much more than just going to jail. Spearing or some sort of really tough physical punishment. But because it happened here in Perth, you know, the police had to, you know, arrest the driver. And when it came to the funeral service, which was held in Karrakatta apparently, when they had the funeral service, the two families were present, because, you know, same tribe. The father and mother are the parents of the dead children, but also the parents of the boy who had actually committed the manslaughter, you'd call it. And there was police presence, because the police wanted to prevent payback. They wanted to prevent sort of the family of the deceased attacking the family of the person who drove the car. And as it happened, in the middle of the service, the father of one of the slain children jumped up and went to for the father of the boy who drove the car. And the police were too slow. Payback time. But this father just put his arms around the father of the boy who'd killed his son and said, "I forgive you." And everybody was just so impressed that that man became an elder. He was seen for his actions as being so wise and compassionate to stop a terrible tragedy just going further into that community, creating more pain, more anger, more separation. But he said he'd broken the tradition. He'd broken the tradition of payback, but everybody saw that that was the right thing to do. Even in indigenous culture, tradition can be changed if there's a good reason for it. In fact, the real tradition is not these ceremonies and these laws and these rules which are laid down from year to year, generation to generation, century to century. What the real tradition is where those rules come from. Why they're there in the first place. Because sometimes what we take to be tradition is not tradition at all. It's just the way those principles are expressed from time to time, from generation to generation, land to land. It's the principles which are the real tradition. And I remember giving another talk on law and religion at UWA just about a year ago, and actually turning to the indigenous representative and just asking him straight out, in indigenous culture, can you change traditions? Is there a mechanism to change? He said, yeah, of course there is. I said, marvelous, then your tradition can survive. Because without that mechanism to change traditions, when we realize the principles behind them are not being used in the way they were intended, then the culture, the tradition, eventually will fall apart. People will reject it. It doesn't make sense anymore. And that's an important thing which I found was in Buddhism from the very beginning. In the Kalama Sutta, it is saying, look, you don't just depend upon traditions. You find out where they come from, why they were there in the first place. I know I've given this simile many times, but it comes in right here, and it's an important one which makes it quite clear what I'm meaning here. It's a difference between the container and the contents. Containers are books, containers are chanting, containers are these ceremonies. But the contents, what do they contain? And the principles are, you know, like peace, like kindness, the forgiveness, justice, truth, love. Those are the principles which sometimes that they're put in a container. How do we express our love? You know, like with flowers. Now that's tradition, isn't it? Give flowers to someone who expresses their love. Please do not give flowers to me. I have hay fever. Yeah, you're showing your love, but look, you're killing me. So it's a tradition, yes, but you know, it doesn't work. Go to where it comes from. You know, how do you express the love? You just want to show it by giving a gift which is useful for us. You know, a good example now is sometimes that people, whenever they give danas, this is gifts to the monastery, they give like, this is Sri Lankans, okay? I'm not getting at you because Thais are worse, Malaysians are just as bad. I don't know how many times I go to a house for some sort of ceremony and people give a towel. We get so many towels. What do you do that for? It's tradition. Because that's what you saw your mother do or your grandmother do. That's what you do in Sri Lanka. Maybe in Sri Lanka, being a hot country, you have to have more showers every day. This is a cold country, especially now. We don't need to shower more than once a day, so we don't wear out the towels that much. So we have a towel for many, many years, so you don't have to keep on giving many towels. I know this monk would be very happy. What people have been doing now, been giving Bunnings vouchers. And that's actually useful because we build monasteries. Now think about it. So keep the tradition. And after a while, it's going to become the tradition. Whenever you see sort of a monk, give him a Bunnings voucher. No, sometimes the monastery's finished. And it's set, don't make that a tradition. Just think and use your heads. But sometimes these traditions mean that we lose what the contents is. What are you doing this for? Where is it coming from? And it's, you only need to make sure that you remember the contents of, you know, the culture or the tradition. In indigenous culture, where did those procedures come from? It's, you know, for some idea of getting some unity in that community, a sense of belonging, a sense of emotional connection and fulfillment with the members of their tribe. Survival is also part where those traditions come from. But go to the heart of those traditions. Where they come from, the contents. And that means the contents, you will never change those. The tradition should really be confined to the contents. And the way those contents are expressed, the containers, they can be changed. So when I say changing tradition, It depends what we mean by the tradition. The contents, where that tradition comes from, never change that, because there's some beautiful things in the way that, you know, we have our family, the way we have our caring together, the way we have some limits to what we do to each other to make sure we don't harm each other. The contents there, just, you know, the love, the being together, the peace, the forgiveness, the harmony, the freedom, those are the contents. They should never be changed. But the container, the way these traditions actually manifest out into the world, please change them from time to time. So you even see like a Buddha statue. That just happens to be a Thai one, because that's what they gave us. But please don't always make Buddha statues that way. This is Australia. We should have a Buddha statue that looks like Australian. So it actually, no, it's true, because it actually relates to people. You know, it's a symbol. We have a relationship with that, just the way that we do things. Even like our monastery. For those of you who go to our two monasteries, the Dhammasara Nuns Monastery in Gijiganap or Bodhinyana Monastery, look at the architecture of that place. It's not like a Thai temple. It's not like a Chinese temple. If you want to see a Chinese temple, go to the one at Guildford Road in Maylands. That looks really Chinese. If you want to see a Tibetan temple, they've got one over in Kamphusik Road in Herne Hill. But our one, look at our dining hall. You know, it's got a two stories, veranda on the top and a veranda on the bottom. What tradition is that? It's Australian pub tradition. Because that's what the hotels look like. You go up in, you know, sort of up country, or they're in Frio, or, you know, where you see these old hotels. That's exactly the style we used. So there's Aussie tradition. And the reason we did it that way, you know, because it's practical. Because by having the veranda all around, on both sides, up and down, and it actually keeps it more cool. It's for this climate. But if you sort of build something, you know, just like in your homeland, yeah, okay, that you may look upon that with nostalgia, but it just doesn't work for the people who actually live there. So now we have monasteries, our tradition, we try and keep, you know, the heart of, you know, where those buildings came from. You know, in Thailand, those big ornate buildings with the high ceilings, they work in that climate. Well, they just don't work in Australia. You know, the Sri Lankan sort of architecture, that's great in that island, but it just don't work in Australia. Or the English architecture. That would, you know, build a castle at the nuns' monastery. No way, that just costs a huge amount to keep warm or keep cold. No, we use the essence, where the tradition comes from, having a peaceful, simple place for people actually to come and get inspired. And one of the traditions which is really important in Buddhism is simplicity, frugality. So we don't waste money, we don't waste things. And that is a tradition which is beautiful, and it's so important in our modern world. We are so wasteful, and you know that. And one of the reasons why our planet is an environmental catastrophe about to happen is because how wasteful we are. To effect proper climate change control, it's not about ETS, emissions trading scheme sort of deals. It's all about using less, and what we have, make sure we use better use of it. You don't need so many robes. That's why we have just one each, or a couple. We've got one spare. Well, we have monasteries which look simple. We don't have chandeliers. We don't have gold. We don't have ornate things. Why? Because the essence of the tradition is simplicity, frugality. So we're going back to the essence here. And this is something which, You know from experience that this is what really religion should really be. Traditional religion, you can see, right, whether it's Christianity or whether it's Islam or whatever, the original religions, we used to live so simply. You know, Jesus just didn't have a home. He just went from place to place, didn't live in big temples, didn't live in big houses. We're trying to live very, very simply. And in fact, it actually says, you know, in the Christian Bible, what is it? It's more difficult for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven, and a woman as well, especially a priest, to enter the kingdom of heaven than a camel to go through an eye of a needle. And I told that story once at the Chinese Chamber of Commerce meeting here in Western Australia, holding the Hyatt. It's a great place to give that simile. And you know, the Chinese Chamber of Commerce in WA, I don't know if there were many Buddhists there, but I tried to get a few converts by telling them, that's what it says in Christianity. That's also, it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. Now there's been lots of discussion about what that actually means, a camel going through the eye of a needle, but whatever interpretation you have for a camel going through the eye of a needle, you know it's damn hard to do. So it's very difficult for a rich man to get into heaven as a Christian. But as Buddhists, we don't have that saying. So it's much easier in Buddhism if you're a rich man to go to heaven. So any rich people here, you better convert soon, because you've got a snowball's chance in hell of going to heaven as a Christian. And I said that as a joke. But you know, it's traditions. How come we've lost our tradition of simplicity and frugality in religion? And we say, no, it's tradition. You know, the Pope before lived here, so now I have to live here. No, you don't have to just follow tradition when you know there must be something wrong in it. And this is something where you can see the religions or a tradition does become strong when it doesn't just follow what the guy before did. Even this is one of the reasons why I love being with a teacher like Ajahn Chah. One of the last teachings he gave, you know, before I came over here to Perth 27 years ago, because just after I came here, a couple of months after I arrived here, Ajahn Chah had a stroke and he didn't teach anymore. So I got some of his last teachings. And I remember him, he'd get his hand out and he'd have his hand like a poo, like a crab. And he'd make this crab walk in a funny way. And he said, once there was a mother crab who had a bad leg. So when she walked, she'd walk with a limp. And she had a lot of baby crabs. And she's told the baby crabs, look, I've got a bad leg, you don't have to walk like this. But nevertheless, all the baby crabs also walk with a limp. And he said, cause that's what baby crabs do, they follow the mother. The mother had a reason for walking with a limp, had a bad leg. The young babies didn't, but they still followed their mother. And Ajahn Chah said, don't you be like that. Now don't just follow what I do, because I've got a limp. And of course, you know, what do people do? They always follow what the teacher did, without really thinking for themselves. This is a problem with traditions. Sometimes the person knows where they're coming from. And they know the contents, but all we see is a container. We go imitating our teacher without realizing where they're coming from. That's why never ever sort of imitate me, never follow me. Please don't just, what I say, just believe because it comes from Ajahn Brahm. And don't even believe that. Very good. Excellent. So the point is here that we have to go to the contents, not the containers, where the traditions come from. So sometimes people ask, Ajahn Brahm, what sort of tradition are you? Is it, you know, Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, Zen, Thailand, Sri Lanka? Well, how many times do I go to Sri Lanka just planning the next trip over to Sri Lanka? Or Malaysia, or Indonesia, and sometimes I go and stay in other people's monasteries. Sometimes people have told me that, you know, I'm a Theravada monk with a Mahayana heart. Don't know what that really means, but I've had these great sort of like arguments with people. You know, I'm supposed to be Theravada, but I'm actually more Mahayana than you are. You know, you sort of sit in your monastery meditating all day. I go out teaching and working. I'm the Bodhisattva, not you. We have these wonderful little arguments. It does not matter what you call yourself. In fact, you know, just where you come from. And where does a good monk, a good nun come from, a good person come from? Don't care if they're in robes or not robes. They're coming from a place of peace, a place of kindness, a place of selflessness, a place of just a relationship to this moment, in, with, as I said earlier, with mindfulness, with kindness. That is a Buddhist. I don't care what tradition you call yourself, it's a Buddhist. Buddhist tradition. Most of those great leaders of religions, they were rebels. The Buddha was a rebel. He turned against, especially the caste system which was there in India at the time. He went against, there was not Hinduism at that time, there was a Brahmanism which was very much into rituals. You know, if you wanted to have good luck, you had to slaughter 100 cows or something. And he said, look, you know, that's not getting you anywhere. It's just creating just more harm, more bad karma by killing all these animals, by making sacrifices and thinking that somehow you're going to get some rain for your crops, or you're going to get wealthy, or the country is going to sort of overcome its enemies. He said, that's not sort of truth. And he went against that. And he went against sort of the way of most people living their lives with lots of possessions, and he just left home. He was so rebellious. According to the tradition, he was a prince, wealthy son, he just left home. That's how sort of rebellious. He was a dropout. And that's, you know what it's like why people drop out. They rebel. This hasn't got any meaning to them. Now that was totally untraditional. There was no filial piety because he did it against his father's wishes. No responsibility for his wife. He left her with a young child. Now that was really rebellious. Now that gives you an idea. Why did he do that? And the reason was because there was something really important. You know, the meaning, truth, you know, real love. You know, not so attachment, but you know, the real love, the love which doesn't have attachments. I know someone asked me to give a talk on the different types of love. You know that I've given a talk on the different types of love. There's a love with attachment and there's a love which frees. And the love which frees, many of you may know, is the love which you may have to your child. It's the love which my father said, son, wherever you go in your life, whatever you do, the door of my heart's always open to you. I free you. You don't have to be like me. You don't have to please me. You don't have to sort of make me proud of you. I'm already pleased with you. I'm already proud of you because you're my son. Just go off into life, do what you feel is the right thing. And you always have my love, no matter what you do. You cannot upset me. Now that's the love which freed. You know, the other type of love is usually, you know, your relationship to your partner. I will love you, darling, as long as, you know, you're nice to me, you cook well, you give me the sex, you don't play around with other people, you always speak nicely to me, blah, blah, blah. It's always, you know, with strings attached. Those are the two types of love. And of course, you know, the sort of love which a rebel has is like a love which frees. Because the idea of rebellion is like freeing. Freeing from some sort of attachments or some sort of chains. And sometimes those traditions, especially when you misunderstood what those traditions are, they just make more chains, less freedom. Whereas really it's supposed to be coming from freedom, coming from a sense of like a love which can free somebody. And this is what original Buddhism was, like freeing people from those obstructions, you know, from the, first of all, from the burden of so many possessions, freeing people from sort of the worries of the past and the future, freeing people, that love which can free you. And the love which can be at peace with yourself, you can say to yourself, the door of my heart is open to me. Not after I change myself to be a goody-goody, but can feed me right now, as I am, all my faults, the way I am, with all my past, I can love me for who I am. That's the type of love which is freeing. And that's the sort of the essence there. But to be able to do that, you have to go sometimes against things. You have to rebel. Basically, you have to think for yourself. And challenge. And argue. And that's why I love Buddhism, because that was one religion I could argue, I could challenge, I could ask questions. And the more you'd ask those questions, the more you'd be respected. And when you did challenge and argue and ask questions of someone like an Ajahn Chah, he never get angry at you. He never say, no, it says in the book, no, my teacher said this is what you're supposed to do. He'd actually encourage you to keep questioning and asking those questions, to keep investigating. He too was a rebel, just like the Buddha. Now, like most monks, where he came from, would live in the villages or the cities. And they would, like many of you know, some of the monks in Thailand, Sri Lanka, and Burma, and other places, you know, seeking for worldly fame and wealth, trying to be comfortable. And, you know, you can have a comfortable life as a monk in some of these cultures. You know, you don't have to go to work, just give a few talks, be kind to people, and they feed you and even give you money. He said, no, that's not the type of monk I want to be. So, you know, he said, no money for monks in my monastery. It's an old rule, but, you know, most monks don't keep that. They will keep the rules of simplicity and frugality. And, you know, he was a rebel. I remember being in his monastery when a group of monks came from Bangkok, you know, the senior monks, to check him out. Because they'd heard that, you know, he was not doing things the way that other monks do. But they saw he was a very good monk, so they left him alone. But he still stirred things up and changed things. Not because he was going against the tradition, but because he was embodying the tradition. He was abandoning the containers, some of the ways that Buddhism was expressed in Thailand at the time, but he was very much conserving the contents, the simplicity and frugality of a monk or a nun. Their peace, their love, the heart of the tradition. And unfortunately, sometimes the traditions do get ossified. We do need rebels. And don't look at me, I'm looking at you. You rebel. Because without that rebelling, without that thinking for yourself, people might come here every Friday and they just become clones of myself or whoever teaches here. Please don't do that. I'm going to try and teach you how to think for yourselves rather than just think like I am doing. Don't, as I say, like Ajahn Chah being like the crab with the sort of the bad leg. And then everybody, all the disciples of that crab also have bad legs. You know I tell terrible jokes. Please don't repeat that to other people. That's just who I am. That's my sort of bad leg. So instead of that, sort of we get this contents of our traditions. And when we get the contents of our traditions right, and the way it's expressed from time to time, from year to year, from country to country, it will change. And it should change. But the heart is always being there the same. So one of the things I'm actually quite proud of, and my predecessor Ajahn Jaka was quite proud of, that even though, you know, I was ordained in Thailand, this is not a Thai monastery. We don't just get Thai people coming here. Very pleased to see so many Sri Lankans, so many Burmese, Vietnamese, Malaysians, Singaporeans, you know, Caucasians. This is the one great success of this community here, to get all the people coming together from so many different traditions. And even like from, you know, Tibetan traditions. I know there's many people who come here on a Friday night and on Saturday and Sunday they go to the Guildford Road Mahayana Temple. Brilliant. Or go to church. Brilliant. Or go to the mosque. Brilliant. This is what we're supposed to be doing. Well, what can you go to the mosque? Do you have to be a Muslim to go to the mosque? Do you have to be a Buddhist to come to the temple? What are you talking about? Our tradition is much deeper than any of that. It's a tradition of wisdom, of truth, of freedom, of love. And I say, wherever you hear that, wherever you can actually learn more about that, go there. Because that's our tradition. So it's very hard to put your name on what that tradition is, but you get the point here. This is something we will never change. And in life, just for example, another example, just yesterday, I was teaching at a seminar in Asia House about death and dying in our different traditions, especially like palliative care when people are dying. That's a very interesting little subject. But I was the only one to bring up the fact that one strategy of palliative care, which no one else of the other religions had the guts to bring up, was euthanasia. That's part of palliative care. Sometimes it's the most compassionate and kind thing to do in some situations. as many of you, I think, would accept. But is that traditional? Just because it hasn't been done before, actually it has been done before, as many of you know, the first person in the whole world who was given legally assisted euthanasia was Mr. Dent, a Buddhist from Darwin. A Buddhist. I'm quite proud of that. Why did he do that? Because it wasn't for himself. He wasn't depressed. He wasn't negative. He did that out of compassion for his wife, who was giving him 24 hours care, even though he could probably get some help, some respite still. His wife felt it was her duty to look after the man she'd loved, who'd cared for her, which meant that she didn't have any freedom at all. Her life was totally caught up with looking after a man who had no quality of life and no prospect of any improvement. So he did that. His main reason, I know this because we knew the guy, was to care for his wife as an act of love to free her. Can you find fault with that? Is that against Buddhism, Christianity, our culture? Isn't life precious? It is precious, but more precious than life is kindness, compassion, love. More precious. This is what I say, we go to the heart of things, the contents, where the tradition is supposed to be coming from. So I brought that up for people. Just, you know, no one else dared to say that. Why is that? Well, it's against our tradition. We can't say that, but Buddhists, we can. Because our tradition doesn't have the constraints, the rules, even the books. I mentioned this before, the books are the containers. They're not the contents. It's what's written in the books which is important. Not sort of the language or how they are. We don't have books and we worship the books. We worship what they say. We read them. I know in some Thai temples especially, they have the Buddhist books in a cabinet. I remember they had this even in Ajahn Chah's monastery, and I couldn't get the key. The key was with somebody else. It was locked up so you couldn't even read them. And there's something wrong there. So the heart of the teachings is not in the books. You can read it in the books, but it's in your heart. That's why you can understand what I'm saying. Because you can feel what I'm saying, that this is our tradition, a tradition of truth. So, yes, Buddhist, certainly. Is it also Christian? I think many of you say, well, it should be. Maybe, you know, the Pope might not say so, but Jesus would. I'm always going to get in trouble for saying things like this. But I think you'll agree with me. Because this is something which everyone can relate to. This is where traditions really begin. So our forest tradition, we're supposed to be Thai forest monks. But what actually is that? That's just a tradition of simplicity. And so some forest monks, they live in wealth and luxury now. Their forests are very like resorts in the forest. But is that really a forest monk? Sometimes we miss it. We got the containers, the outer appearances, but without the heart. And that is the problem. So I am very, very devoted to my tradition. And sometimes I look upon myself as being a conservative, a really conservative monk, even a fundamentalist monk. But I go to the fundamentalist contents which I understand from the Buddha. You know, that peace, that freedom, that forgiveness, that love, that to me is fundamentalism. However, what most people look at fundamentalism, it's not really fundamentalism at all. It's just preserving the container at all costs, even though you can see on the outside of the container the use-by date is many centuries ago. But we still keep those old traditions. Why? It's just because it's a tradition. It's just because of the way we do that. A good example of that, another one. In the parliaments of this country, Australia, state and federal, before they meet, they say the Christian Lord's Prayer. And you know, you see it in the newspapers. People object to that. And they say, well, no, it's our tradition. We've always done that. What's the meaning behind? Why did you have that tradition in the beginning anyway? So we have to keep the meaning behind it, which was giving some spiritual message to the beginning of the day of the politicians who govern our state and our country. We should keep the meaning behind that, but its expression, a Christian prayer, which probably most of those politicians don't even believe in anyway, that should be taken away. Keep the contents, but please change the containers to fit time and place, for goodness sake. If we don't do that, then we're missing out. And if we keep the old containers too long, we forget what the contents were, what the original meaning of that was. I mentioned a few days ago why Buddhists bow. We don't bowing because we're praying to something. We're not bowing just because that's what our parents did, if you're a traditional Buddhist. We're bowing because that's an act of respecting. Remember what I said a couple of weeks ago? First time, virtue. Second time, peace. Third time, compassion or wisdom. That's what I bow to. Now when I was told that, I understand what the purpose was, what the contents of this ritual was. So it's got meaning for me now. But yet sometimes people bow and you ask, what do you do that for? I don't know. Just what other people said. Sometimes I tell a joke that people who bow a lot, you should bow a lot because it gives your stomach muscles exercise so you don't get so fat. Because you know, it's like bow, 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 and this gets very... Didn't work for me, but nevertheless... But that's not what we bow for. All of these rituals, all of these traditions, there's a meaning behind it. If you don't understand that meaning, forget. Now why do... Now sometimes you come in here, you're told you can't point your feet at the Buddha. Is that right or wrong? Why? Who knows why? Oh, I don't know. Exactly! It becomes just a tradition. You haven't got a clue what it's there for. And it's only because in Asian culture, that was regarded as totally disrespectful. Your feet were supposed to be the lowest part of your body, so you shouldn't point it at something which you respect. That's all it was. In this country, just pointing your feet at people, is that wrong? Of course, it's a tradition which was in Asian. So these days, if somebody has got sore knees, please put your feet out. Compassion is more important than that. Look, I've seen a couple of you with head coverings on. You know that's actually also, you're not supposed to give a talk to people with a head covering on. Because that was also supposed to be disrespectful, but you're cold. This is Australia in sort of, you know, cold weather time. So keep them on. Because more important than these traditions is compassion and kindness. You know, sometimes people that come to a monastery, they won't even sit on a chair because they're higher than the monks and they feel very upset about that. And they keep saying, no, kindness, compassion is more important than that. This is where that came from. You can still respect in so many different ways. So be careful. Sometimes traditions get in the way of truth. So in the end, how can you actually find out, you know, what traditions you should keep? Go to the contents and you know they're right. And how do you know they're right? It's something which we do in Buddhism to know what the tradition is, how we can find out what that truth is. As I said in that Kalama Sutta, you're not supposed to depend upon tradition, not supposed to depend on what's in the books, not even on reason, because you know people can reason. You just go to these debates. You know, if you listen to Tony Abbott or Kevin Rudd or the other politicians, they can argue, and it's both logical. And when I listened to one of them, I said, oh, that really makes sense. And then listen to the other one, oh, that made sense too, but you're saying totally opposite things. Be careful on reason and logic, because sometimes you can't really trust on it. So in the end, what can we trust? How can we know? In your heart, but sometimes you get it wrong in here too, don't you? This is why the most important thing about the Buddhist, which again, which made me love it, it told you how to find out and how to trust what you experience. It is meditation, but in particular, that part of meditation which makes sure you put aside all your desires, just for the time being. Because when you've got a desire, you only see what you want to see. Hear what you want to hear. Feel what you want to feel. It's the trouble with desire, it bends the truth to fit us. And you let go of negativity, denial, not wanting to see what is actually true, but which may be uncomfortable for you. what Al Gore said, an inconvenient truth. He didn't just mean that, you know, global warming. There's many inconvenient truths in your life which, you know, we'd rather not look at. But when you let go of that negativity, when you let go of that desire, then actually you can trust that what you experience is truthful, is real. You're not bending it. You're not filtering out all the facts. How do you do that? Look, what does desire do? Takes you off into some future possibility. What's negativity, especially anger, all about? All about something which happened in the past. Just a very simple training in being present. Being here. Not going off into the future, that's called desire. Not lingering in the past, which is mostly ill will. What somebody did to you. Or what you did to someone else. Being in this present moment. There in the present moment you're actually experiencing life. This is life. If you're really mindful in this moment, you can't really miss it. You know what truth is. You know what love is. Especially in silence. Because when you start speaking, it's always you're lingering in the past again. What happened? You're giving a description to an event which has just passed. In that silence, there you're with this reality. Not sort of covering up with the labels and interpretations. You're here, being. You be here long enough. Then of course you know what love is, you know what truth is, you know what peace is. So that becomes our holy book. That silent present moment in the heart. That's where you understand what the truth is. That is our tradition. We are a meditation tradition, that's our heart, that's our contents. And all the truth you get from there. And all the traditions, all the manifestations, all the things which we do, all come from that. The Buddha sat under a Bodhi tree. The first temple, the first monastery, just a tree. Simple. Why? Because it was just peaceful, with hardly anything added to it. And over the centuries we've added so much more. But as long as we remember the Bodhi tree, the heart, the peace, the silence, then we understand that where Buddhism comes from. It comes from just quietly being in the present moment under a tree with nothing else around. That's our tradition. What a tradition is that? Is that Theravada? Is that Mahayana? Is that Tibetan? Is that Christianity? Is that Islam? That's only when the mind starts to move and starts to give things names. In the present moment, in that silence, we're actually experiencing the reality where it doesn't have any names. Then also there's no divisions left. That's our peace. That's our meaning. So you hang around there long enough, you'll understand where all these traditions come from. You keep that tradition. Tradition of silence, present moment, mindfulness. That's even more fundamental than love. Love comes from that. Comes from that present moment silence. That's where peace comes from. That's where freedom comes from. That's our tradition. That's what we worship. So if someone asks me, what's my tradition? Peace is my tradition. Love is my religion. Freedom is my goal. So that cuts against so much, please excuse me, bullshit. Is it right for a monk to say that? Traditionally it's not. But now I think you'll understand why. Thank you for listening. Very good. Is it traditional to clap? If you feel like it, do it. If you don't, don't. Okay, thank you for listening. Now, any questions or comments on this evening's talk? You got one, Jenny, yes.
Yeah. I wanted to comment that euthanasia and palliative care are very separate things, and palliative care doesn't encompass euthanasia.
Okay. Traditionally. Thank you for saying that. I could pick up. You were saying that traditionally, and I'll put what you said at the end of the beginning, palliative care and euthanasia sort of don't usually come together at all. There's a big gulf, and I would say, why is there a gulf there? traditionally it doesn't come together, but in all of the tools of palliative care, why can't that be one of the strategies? Why not?
And I can appreciate that, because sometimes you can have a case that is absolutely miserable in it, and it seems like this would be the time for palliative care. But mostly I see the Buddhist reason for palliative care because the process is a beautiful process and it gives people time to
Yes, the Buddhist idea is to give people time to go through the whole experience of dying without too much either spiritual, mental or physical discomfort. But I mean, I'm just going off on this one now. Last October I went to visit my mother in London who's got dementia. She's in a pretty good state even though she can't remember me. But there was other people in that home which was very well appointed. Excellent care. That British National Health Service, they do a huge amount, at least in that home. I was very impressed with the level of care which everybody in that sort of facility was given. But nevertheless, I saw one or two women in there who were terrified. And I'm a sensitive monk because maybe meditation, you could understand just what they were feeling. Imagine you woke up tomorrow morning in a totally foreign place with people you didn't recognize, and there was nothing there for you to know, nothing familiar at all, you'd be terrified. And I saw these women who were waking up every moment in that terror. Every moment they were being woken up in a place they couldn't recognize, with people they didn't know, with no past or future to really give them any sense of belonging anywhere. Cast adrift totally in this universe with no reference point. And you could see their terror. And that was something which nothing could take away. That was incredible dementia. And I could know that because sometimes, you know, I travel a lot. I wake up in the morning and I'm in a new hotel with my new monastery, somewhere else, you know, some other country or place, and I have to look around and see, where the hell am I? And it takes a few minutes to remember, oh yeah, I'm in sort of Makassar, or I'm in Borneo today, or I'm in Singapore, or I'm in Frankfurt or somewhere, because I travel around a lot. I just take that and amplify it 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times, and see the pain in that person. And of all the people I've seen, well, no, it's not all the people, that's one person I see, look, that's something with the best care in the world, can't help. But euthanasia maybe could.
Yes, and I see that. Disease process is so gross.
Disease process is so gross, really suffering.
It's a hard place for me to be at as a palliative care nurse.
Yeah. Yeah, the idea of karma, remember, karma is not a punishment, they don't have to do this. If that was the case, every time I got a headache I would never take a Panadol, every time I was sick I would never go to the doctor, I think, my goodness, this is karma, I just have to better deal with this. No, of course we do these things. If there's a way out, we take it. It's called compassion. So this was actually, I was just challenging, I love being challenging like this, throwing out things out into the air, which, because I'm untraditional. Because when there's new ways of thinking, you know, being untraditional, we're actually keeping the tradition of the truth and the heart. You throw these things out, it actually makes people think. Like just there was before that Melbourne conference on, was it the of all those religions, the World Parliament of Faiths. They had a meeting here in Perth just to discuss what to do. And I said, I've asked them, I said, well, you've got the Christians coming, the Buddhists, yeah, we've got the Buddhists coming here, the Muslims, and you've got the indigenous faiths this year. I said, but have you got the atheists this year? That's not a religion. But I said, no, Cardinal Pell said they were. You know, they were sort of, you know, like an anti-religion religion. I said, so they should be there too. They weren't very happy with me. Because to me it belonged, and it'd be great to have the atheists there. Together with the religion, because they go together. It's the same sort of, you know, opposite teams, but you know, they're still on the same sort of type of sport. That's what I thought anyway. So I love throwing those things out there just to make people think. And yeah, euthanasia is, I would say, a form of palliative care. Fulfills the, in a sense, the compassion and the care which one wants to give to a person in those months or years of their finality in this life. So it's interesting. But that's when you are traditional, you can't even ask those questions. But when you find the tradition of the contents, where did palliative care come from? So I also said, you know, why are people doctors or nurses? You're there to care for people, not to cure them. I said that's one of my sayings. Any doctors, nurses here, your main priority is not to cure that patient. Your main priority is to care for them. So care for them first. If they die, they die, but at least they've been cared for. But if curing is the most important, sometimes you give them hell. Why do you got to get them better? But you're not caring for them. Care, care, care. That's the heart of being a doctor, being a nurse. You're in the caring professions, not in the curing profession. Care for them. Sorry, I'm just spouting on any questions. One last question from Chris and then we finish off here. Yeah. Indeed, that sometimes is a price to pay for sort of challenging sort of traditions. But when you make the point that you're not sort of taking away all traditions, I think what was it? There's a saying which I often come across which I really object to. I think C.S. Lewis says, when you cease to believe in God, you believe in anything. As if that's the only tradition. That container and contents are one and the same thing. When you throw everything away, you've got nothing left. I say, no. That was a container, that's a particular expression of truth. The contents, the love, the kindness, you will still believe in that. And you look to sort of, I noticed I saw this, somebody some time ago downloaded Intelligence Squared debate between Stephen Fry, Christopher Hitchens, against a Nigerian archbishop and the British MP Anne Widdecombe. They were both staunch Catholics, against Stephen Fry, you know, a gay actor, and Chris Hitchens, you know, who's just even more atheist than Richard Dawkins. And it was a great debate, and I really enjoyed watching that. But again, that was where you could see that all four of them, they believed in love. The debate was Catholicism a force for good in the world? The Catholic Church, was it a force for good in the world? And they argued both ways. And you could see what they did agree with. They were all really loving, caring people. So that was their tradition they shared. And if we throw away the Catholicism or the atheism or the being gay or the being this or that and go to what we share together, now that is our tradition. That's our human tradition. And that's what Buddhism is trying to get back to. Not getting a separate religion, separating from other people, but getting that to the core of things. That's why sometimes there's one of the great sayings of the Buddha. He said, I never argue with the world, but the world argues with me. That's a great little saying. I never argue with the world, but the world argues with me. How can you argue with love, with kindness, with freedom, with compassion, with peace? That's something which unites us. That's our tradition. Everything else, the way it's expressed, will it change from time to time? And that way, people will have something they can rely on. And they will join sort of a bandwagon, which is actually, for a change, going in the right direction. I don't think I can stop you, so please. And woman made as well, be fair. Action, reaction. Yeah.
There's an equal amount of opposite reactions. So you're not falling, that's why
you suffer. That's right, yeah.
That's why you left behind the teaching. We should be following the teaching and not the...
The external manifestations, yeah. Yeah. See, use your language. Thank you. Thank you, no, that's fine. No, that's enough now. We've had you. Thank you. Thank you, Eddie.